From the frozen studios of Univest at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another unpredictable episode of Chemical-Free Horticultural Hijinks You Bet Your Garden. Are you one of many gardeners struggling to understand the sudden loss of many of your supposed perennial plants? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, a listener in Nashville helps me to understand what's going on and why it may get worse. Plus, your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and arithmetically adroit enunciations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens, because it's all coming up faster than your crepe myrtle staying dead. Right after this.
J.L. Hudson Seeds has supported You Bet Your Garden and enthusiastic growers for more than 25 years. To learn more about the world's most eclectic seed company, visit jlhudsonseeds.net.
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I answered a question on the show a couple of weeks ago about weird growth at the top of people's crepe myrtles in Nashville. I had no clue. I had no idea. But you know me, that didn't stop me from answering the question. Well, we have a listener who told us what actually happened, and it is a phenomenon that could be, or should be, or will be, or is interesting to all of yous out there. But we'll get to that after your fabulous phone calls at 888-492-9444. Ricky, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, and we spoke a little bit beforehand, and I understand that your husband Larry is standing by, and he's going to butt in at some point.
Every chance I get, Mike.
Okay, so where are Ricky and Larry?
Well, right now we are in Kent, New York, at our vacation home. It's right on Lake Ontario.
Oh, okay.
It's halfway between Rochester and Buffalo.
And we're preparing for the solar eclipse.
Oh, okay. Are you in totality? It'll be over by the time this phone call airs, but just curiously.
That's right. Yep, yeah. We're in totality here.
Okay. All right. So you got a summer place on the lake, and is that where your question is?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Ricky, tell me what's going on.
So we planted a honey locust tree about 2 years ago. It's not on the lake side. It's on the other side of the house. And in November, I noticed that the bark was splitting on the actual tree trunk. And I thought that was weird that it was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I did reach out to our people that did our gardens, but they never really got back to us. They didn't put the tree in, but I just thought they could give me some information. And then I decided just to email you.
Yes, and you sent us some pictures that were actually up on our Facebook page a couple of weeks ago. Now, there's two things that can cause the kind of damage I see on your tree. Do you know, and it has a wound on one side that does not go all the way around. It's split open, right?
That's correct.
Do you know what side that's facing? Southeast, west, north?
Southeast.
Okay. If the crack was a different size and shape, I would say it could be sun scald, especially if this is in an area like near the Great Lakes where the temperature swings can be crazy. Because as you know, it can be really cold, but very bright and sunny. Okay, so it's facing south and east. Now, if the damage was slightly different, if it was more of a crack than a gash, I would say it might be sun scald, which very young trees especially are prone to. As you know, it can be the coldest winter day. And you know this when you get into your car and it's blessedly hot. But if the sun is shining directly on the bark, it's going to warm the bark up. And then if it plummets that night, the sap that got flowing in that warmed up area can freeze and it can actually crack the bark open. A lot of people who plant new trees that are facing south and southeast will coat that part of the trunk with white latex paint, and that'll reflect the rays of the sun. It won't heat up so much, and it won't crack. But yours is not a crack. Yours is a gash. And especially at the height it is, it's almost certainly deer damage, but not deer nibbling. When young male deer are progressing and putting on their antlers come out with this furry substance that people call velvet, and they want to get that off their antlers. So what they do is they, quote, velvet their antlers. Maybe it is an answer. They rub the antlers up against a tree to get this stuff off, and they can cause a pretty significant amount of damage. Now, your tree, the damage is all on one side. Interestingly, it's on that warm side, too. So, you know, maybe that even felt good if it was a sunny day. But that's what happened. They rubbed their antlers against the tree. They broke off part of the bark. And, you know, it happens in nature all the time. A lot of people, when they plant new trees, will use tree guards. These are plastic tubes, but they're not solid plastic. They kind of wrap around, so they give with the tree when it grows. And that protects them from both sun scald and deer damage early on. You know, you want to take that off in the spring and summer. And after the tree is well established, you don't need it anymore. But also, in your photographs, you showed me that the tree is planted in a box of some kind. It looks like a wooden box filled with wood chips.
Yes.
Why is that? Hello?
Decorative? I don't know.
Okay.
We have taken that off.
Oh, okay.
I read your email and you suggested we do that, and so we did.
Yeah, anytime you do something decorative to a tree, it's almost always leading to fatality or illness. I know okay. We like to see like things wrapped around the base of a tree, but that bark needs to breathe and it needs to dry out. By covering the bottom of the tree with that bark in a box, you're maintaining the highest level of moisture in there, and that's going to rot the trunk of the tree and make it open to different wood-eating insects that'll hide down there, maybe even mice, voles. They'll eat the tender bark, again, especially in a young tree. So whenever you plant a tree, you want to plant it high so you can see the root flare. You can see the top of the root system coming up out of the ground, and then you never pile up anything around it. But if then you want to mulch it, you start about 6 inches out from the trunk and you mulch out as far as the farthest branch goes. And that will prevent weeds from growing near the tree. And it'll also keep moisture in the soil where the roots are. You know, there's no roots directly under a tree. So you want to keep the moisture in the soil underneath the feeder roots, underneath the ones that are furthest away from the trunk. And even though it's counterintuitive, having the top of the tree above ground is the best way to prevent that tree from falling over in a storm.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah. So is the tree going to live?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If it had been girdled all around, which sometimes happens, then there's no way for water and nutrients to transfer from the top to the bottom. But now you've just got a scar, and it'll be there. It's part of the tree. It's part of life. I got more scars than I, you know, if they'll never have a problem identifying my body, you know. And that's just part of the tree, but it should be nice and healthy after that. And you may want to consider putting a tree guard up, certainly on any new trees you plant, and plant them high.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for the information. It was nice talking to you.
All right. And you too, take care now.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Two little bugs. Two little bugs. Two little bugs in a box. Little bug. One little bug. One little bug.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that I will return to the Allentown Public Library on Tuesday, May 7th at 6:30 to present a free lecture or whatever you want to call it, in which we will discuss whatever is on your collective gardening minds. And it's free. But don't go thinking up your questions just yet, because we'll be right back with the effects of weird weather on your plants and more of your weird phone calls. I'm Weird Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA.
J.L. Hudson Seeds has supported You Bet Your Garden and enthusiastic growers for more than 25 years. To learn more about the world's most eclectic seed company, visit jlhudsonseeds.net.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a very interesting question of the week for you. We had a phone call a couple of weeks back about a crazy looking growth on top of a crepe myrtle or several crepe myrtles, and I had no clue as to what was going on, but of course that didn't stop me from pretending to know the answer. Well, a listener heard us and learned me what the real answer was, and it's something we should all be keeping in mind when we lose a plant. And we'll tell you what that is after more of your fabulous phone calls at 888-492-9444. Greg, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Greg. I will tell our listeners right away that this is a setup. I got a wonderful email from you and asked you to be on the show to tell your story. And I am very partial to our listeners in Southeast Alaska as well. You're in Haines, correct?
Yep, I'm in Haines, known for its Anway strawberries and its bald eagles.
Yeah, oh my God, you are so lousy with bald eagles. It's ridiculous. When I spoke to the Southeast Alaska Master Gardeners many years ago, I stayed at a bed and breakfast in Juneau that was on a lake, and I thought there was snow cap in the trees or something until something startled them, and then hundreds of eagles just took flight at once.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. In the fall, we get as many as 2,000 in a 2 or 3 mile stretch of the highway just north of Haines.
My daughter and I, she was 8 years old, and I decided to take her with me. And we took the ferry back to the mainland, the Alaska Marine Highway. And one of the last days we were there, I'm pretty sure it was in Juneau, a friend of mine took me to one of these rough stone beaches where every rock you pick up has some sort of science fiction creature underneath. And And an eagle dove into the water right in front of us, came up with a fish. And then literally 2 feet in front of us, another eagle came along and grabbed a hold of it. And they struggled over this fish while we watched. It was like IMAX.
Yeah, it's really fun to watch them. And they compete a lot. And eagles, surprisingly, are pretty good swimmers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think the one that took the fish went down into the water and came back out again.
Yeah, they usually are wings like fins and stay on top of the water and just get their way to the shore. Sometimes they have a fish that's too big and they can't really pick it up and fly, so they have to swim with it and its tail onto the shore and pack it at them and compete with the other eagles trying to get it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area. If anybody out there has a chance to visit the Inside Passage in Southeast Alaska, I urge them to. It is, it's a wilderness beyond belief. Now, I asked you to be on the show so that you could relate a story you told me about your mother, your grandmother.
Well, actually, it's an old woman who has passed away since then. She lived to be 101. She lived here, was born and raised here in Haines, Alaska. And she, I would visit her on Sundays, and she'd tell me lots of stories. You had a topic where you were talking about the power of horse manure.
Right.
In different ways, meaning the heat in particular. So I had called because I wanted to tell you one little story. She told me that her father, Henry Vermeer, when she was a little girl, so that would put it probably in 1920s somewhere, was paid by the city of Haines to put horse manure around the fire hydrants to keep them warm during the wintertime. So the heat from the horse manure is particularly warm and sustaining, and I just thought it was a nice tidbit of information for you. Since then, I've heard that we've actually even had wildlife come to sit on piles of horse manure in areas where we had horse stalls and people would dump their manure, and moose even would come and lay down on top of the horse manure. So it's warm stuff. Yeah, it's good.
And I know that I was in Juneau, I was in Ketchikan, I was in Haines. I remember that you guys can grow cabbages the size of the Empire State Building, and I think you mentioned your legendary strawberries, but it can be a little bit chilly there to get tomatoes and peppers, and that a lot of people who wanted to grow those crops had some sort of a greenhouse set up in their backyard.
Yeah, that's right.
And it just occurs to me that a great way to heat that greenhouse would be with fresh horse manure.
Unfortunately, there's probably 3 horses in our whole valley now. It's gotten so expensive for hay. We used to have quite a few horses. But yeah, there are a lot of greenhouses. And although we are known for our fruit trees and our strawberries, you're right, tomatoes and peppers, and those have to be in greenhouses. And people try to grow corn on the cob, but it's it has to be a really warm, hot summer to get that. We do get nice summers here. It can be in the 80s, but we also get a lot of rain and clouds, and the temperature is pretty cool. But we're right on the coast, so our temperatures rarely get to zero in the winter time. They do on occasion, but the weather's pretty inclement. We get lots of rain and clouds often, even in the wintertime.
See, that's what I think there's this big misconception that as soon as you say Alaska, you see sled dogs. But your climate in up and down the Inside Passage, and I call them islands. I don't know how you guys refer to the various areas that are separated by bodies of water. But it's a very mild climate, really.
Yeah, it is a mild climate. But, you know, we're right on the coast here, up just as the, you know, Canada's just a few miles from us here. But as soon as you go a mile up the road or 2 miles up the road, well, if you go up 10 miles up the road, and the temperature varies so much as soon as you get to the interior, and 20 miles up the road is a Tlingit Native village, and their temperatures are much colder than what we have in the wintertime. But then again, in the summertime, they're much warmer. So that all varies. But, you know, you go much further than that up over the mountain passes into Canada and then back into Alaska again. And the temperatures get very cold in the winter. And yes, people do use dog sleds in the wintertime, but it's for sport more than anything else.
Right. And that's the, quote, real Alaska as opposed to the southeastern Alaska, which is just a wonderful place. I took my daughter there. We flew in and we took the ferry back. But the day we arrived, I didn't realize it was springtime. And we had trouble going to sleep. It was still bright out at 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of interesting how I had a vacation rental for about 10 years and people would come from other states. And yeah, 11 o'clock at night and you can go outside and the daylight, you don't need flashlights. You could read a book out there. And of course, the further north you go, if you go way up north in Alaska, it doesn't get dark at all. The sun doesn't set. But then, of course, it's the reverse in the wintertime where it gets dark most of the day. And in some places way up north, the sun never shines for a month or so. Here where we are, we're in the more southern part on the coast here. And in the winter, we probably get about 6 hours of daylight each day. And in the summer, we get probably 20 hours of daylight.
Oh, I know. I know.
Right
people now. were telling me how nuts they get in the summertime.
Yeah. People insisted, guests would insist on having curtains and a lot of people that live here don't even bother. They just kind of get used to it. It's so gradual, you know, that you get used to the daylight and lack of daylight.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for reminding us of the power of fresh horse manure. It's not a good fertilizer because it's still full of weed seeds. But if you need a heat source, there's nothing like it. Okay. Well, thank you,
yeah.
Greg. Great to talk to you.
Well, you're welcome. And nice to talk to you. Have a good day. Bye.
You too, sir. Bye bye. Sue, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, too. Sue, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Happy that spring has come to Tennessee. Irises are up, roses are blooming, and it's way too early.
Now, I should constantly remind people that we record the show like 10 days in advance. So I don't have any roses blooming yet. I have a lot of new growth, but my tulips are up and, you know, my crabapple tree is in flower. And this is the time of year where you pray, no rainstorms. Let me enjoy this tree for like 3 days before it loses all its blossoms.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're in what part of Tennessee?
The geographic center, about 30 miles southeast of Nashville.
Okay, very well. And that would be?
What just happened there?
The name of the town.
Oh, Murfreesboro.
Okay. And what can we do for Sue in Tennessee?
Okay, I have a oak tree that is probably more than 50 years old. It's huge, and every spring it drops all this stuff, and I don't even know what it is, if it's pollen or, you know, it's when the leaves start bursting out. And you know, there's a lot of debris everywhere on my roof, on the front yard, the backyard, and I'm just wondering if that is something I can use as a mulch, if I should put it in my compost bin. What should I do with it? It seems like a waste, you know, just to throw it away.
There is a lot of stuff that can come down from certain trees at this time of year. And you're very close when you use the word pollen. Now, is this a live oak?
I think, you know, I've had a hard time figuring out what it is. I think it might be a water oak or a swamp white oak.
Okay.
I've never really been able to identify it.
All right. Yeah,
you know, conclusively.
There was a great book written about oak trees years ago where the author talked about the difficulty in determining, you know, what kind of oak it was or whether it was an oak. And he said, there's one thing all oak trees have in common, and that's acorns.
Yes, it has lots of acorns.
And your debris has to do with acorns.
Really?
Yes. What you are seeing all over your deck and around your house, and oaks are famous for this, is the male part of the flowering system that eventually produces acorns. They're called, and I apologize to horticulturalists, I think they're called catkins, C-A-T-K-I-N-S.
Okay.
And they are the male part of the equation. Oak trees will produce female flowers. And you wouldn't even, I don't think they call them flowers. That's why they came up with the name catkins, because these are male pollinating plants. They release all their pollen, which is when you can't, you know, when you can't stop sneezing for a week at a time and your car turns a different color.
Oh, yes.
But then when all the pollen is released, you've got these very large structures that the tree has created, kind of tangles. It almost looks like dead, dried out parts of some evergreens that are twisty, but they fall in large numbers and in large amounts. And yes, they are biomass that is very useful. Now, because they are only the male part of the equation, in nature, it's the guys who show up first, checking their watches, smoking cigarettes, wondering when the girls are going to come out. And then the flowers open, the males release all their pollen, and all trees release massive amounts of pollen because they want to make sure they get to the female flowers, and then those pollen producing parts drop to the ground. Some of them are insignificant. Yours are some of the most noticeable. But because they were only the male part of the equation, it's not like they're seeds. It's not like if you use them, you know, if you planted them, nothing would come up. Because it's just a dead guy down there. He's not doing anybody any good. But in your region, Extension Services actually promote the use of this more as a mulch than as a compost ingredient.
Okay.
But I would say you can be happy either way. As a mulch, it's going to cover the surface of the soil. It's going to prevent weed growth, but it's not going to cause a million oak trees to sprout up.
Okay.
And it would be an excellent material in your compost pile, and a really interesting one, you know, because we always talk about greens, fresh material, and browns, dried material.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know that these things are brown, light brown.
Yeah.
Right. And they're finished, but they were green not that long ago. So I would certainly use them in a compost pile like shredded leaves.
Okay.
You know, shred them up if you can. But I think they're also going to contain a fair amount of nitrogen, in their early stage like this. So, yes, it's a tremendously valuable resource that as a gardener or someone who has a landscape, you should capture and use.
Super. Good. I'm glad because I won't have to move them very far to use them as a mulch. That's terrific.
Yeah, I don't have that issue. What I have is tulip poplar trees.
Yeah.
And they're different because they drop their, quote, flowers. And
yes.
These are the size of real tulips. And you can get a yard covered with this thing, these things, and you just scratch your head.
Yeah, we have those around here, too.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, you know, when they're done doing what they're doing, they get out of the way so the new fruits can form, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the shredded leaves. Last fall, I put shredded leaves on all my garden beds, my landscape beds. What do I do with that now? If I'm going to plant, do I dig it in?
No,
No.
Don't seize defeat from the jaws of victory.
Okay.
If you have shredded leaves covering your bed, what you go out and do now is you gently rake them off to the side to allow the soil to warm up.
Okay.
And then after 2 weeks, the soil should be nice and warm for your planting. And then you go back and replace the mulch that you, because as you know, some oak leaves especially, they last forever. They make a great mulch because they don't break down very rapidly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But never mix any dry brown material into your soil or you will cause problems. Plus, you're doing more work than you need to.
Right, yeah. I just didn't want to do the wrong thing.
Right, exactly. No, it's good to move it around right now to warm up the soil, but then go back and use it as a mulch.
Okay, that's what I'll do. I'm ready for planting.
As are we all. Our fingers are itchy. All right, well, good luck to you this season.
Okay, thank you so much, and you too.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there once again that I will return to the Allentown Public Library on Tuesday, May 7th at 6:30 for a free event. That's what I said, free, in which I'll discuss whatever is on your collective gardening minds and maybe present a few tips and tricks of my own. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with an explanation for what might be wiping out some of your most precious plants and more of your precious phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA.
This is 91.3 FM, WLVR Bethlehem, WLVR.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. A couple of weeks ago, I fumbled my way trying to find an answer to what was killing or making the crepe myrtles in Nashville look ugly, and I was beyond clueless. I would have had to climb up 6 rungs on a ladder to get to clueless. But luckily, we have wonderful listeners, and one of them wrote in to explain what had really happened. And it's something we all need to keep in mind as we proceed through this difficult new world of gardening in a climate-changed world. So stay tuned. We'll get right to it. But right now, 888-492-9444. Sandy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm just ducky, Sandy. How are you?
I'm good. I figured.
Actually,
I'm having trouble out here in Egg Harbor Township with my my tree roots invaded my raised beds, and my husband doesn't want to move the garden.
Okay, well, that's understandable. Do we know what kind of roots got in there?
There's a big pine tree. There's a maple tree. There's bushes, like, all within, like, say, 15 feet of the garden. And it looks like they're coming in from all sides.
From all sides. That would be unusual. Well, I would implicate the maple tree.
Yeah.
Now, I'm looking at a picture here of concrete blocks, cinder blocks with an overturned wheelbarrow. Is that you?
Yeah, that's me.
So your frames are, well, is this a raised bed that I'm looking at, or is it a compost bin?
No, it's a raised bed.
Okay, because it...
And my husband was digging it out and just kind of showing you what we were fighting.
Okay. And I'm looking at this picture, and there's a note here. Could using soaker hoses have contributed to this? And what were 6 inches down, the roots or the soaker hoses?
The soaker hose.
Okay. So you got a couple of options here. When something like this happens, you can, you know, spend a little bit of time removing as much as the roots as you can. Then if you want to just be done with this problem, you would install what's called rhizome barrier that would, you know, you'd make a little trench, you'd put the rhizome barrier in there. Better to have it installed professionally, but that's up to you. And that would prevent the roots from coming through. They would simply turn to the side when they got to the rhizome barrier.
How deep would they have to be, the rhizome barriers?
Well, it depends. As you excavate the area, you'll see how deep the roots go. So in that case, the tree will tell you. I will also tell you that if it is coming from the maple, multi-directional has me confused here, but if it is coming from the maple, which is the most likely, you could actually trench out the roots on that side and sever them without harming the tree, as long as you don't remove more than 20% of the root system of the tree. So, you know, if you wanted to rent a trench digging tool once a season, you could run that sucker around the entire garden area, and you'd buy you'd buy yourself another year. The other option is to make the bed much higher. What I would recommend is you lay down hardware cloth, which is metal that prevents roots and things from coming through. And then instead of like a foot high or whatever, you make the bed a good 2 feet high. And one of the things that we've been learning is if you don't want to use that much compost or topsoil or perlite, you can lay down wood from your property on the bottom over top of the hardware cloth and then fill it up. And what would happen is the wood will slowly disintegrate and it'll turn into soil, but you won't have the expense of filling up an even bigger box, so to speak. So I think that would be the easiest solution. And yes, the soaker hoses are a problem because these roots are seeking out water. I'm wondering if you could even deke them by running the hoses off to the side and the roots will turn over and, you know, go over there for a change. But I would not bury the soaker hoses. I would have them on the surface of the soil. may be covered by a very light mulch of shredded leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So those are your options.
Okay. That sounds like a plan.
Okay. Sounds like several plans. You just have to pick one. I'll tell you, I have no idea how old you guys are, or what kind of shape you're in, but you will never regret making a raised bed taller.
Okay, yeah. We're getting up there in age. So.
You know, so you put in the work now, and you have easy pickings for the next couple of years.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Mike.
All right, good luck to you. All right, as promised, a rather unusual question of the week. We hope you like it. We're calling it What to Do When Weather Wins. A couple of weeks ago, I answered a call on the show about crepe myrtles behaving badly. Now, I kind of answered it. No, maybe I didn't. Anyway, a listener in Tennessee explained that the growth on top of their crepe myrtles had gotten all dead and stringy, for lack of a better word, and hoped to learn why. I had no clue. No clue! Ha! I was several levels below no clue. I would have had to go up the rungs on a ladder to reach clueless. But, of course, that didn't stop me. I've been fascinated by crepe myrtles ever since my older brother moved to the Virginia Beach area to teach high school, and I began driving there from Philly several times each summer to sleep on his couch and swim at the secret beaches that are south of the resort area. The drive took me on a long stretch of Route 13 along the eastern shore that was lined with massive crepe myrtles. The annual appearance of their dramatic flowers at the end of the season would remind me that summer was coming to an end, which was fine, as the ocean water was deliciously warm in September and the tourists were all gone. Wait a minute. Did this just turn into some sort of horticultural travelogue? No. I'm just revealing how I came to love these plants, even though Pennsylvania was too far north to grow them back then. But as the climate changed, myrtles began showing up in Maryland, then Delaware, then Pennsylvania and New Jersey. I quickly learned to urge my listeners not to commit the all-too-common crime of crepe murder by cutting these poor plants back to the ground every spring. Yeah, they could survive these savage attacks, but they would never look right afterwards. Ideally, you cut them back in the spring by how much they grew the previous year. If they had gone from 6 feet tall to 8, you cut off 2 feet, and the flowers would stay at eye level, and the plant would not get all scraggly and unbalanced looking. So I suggested that our listeners' plants had been mispruned or gone unpruned or pruned late in the fall, which is always a bad idea for any plant, or some other malfeasance or nonfeasance with sharp objects. And while I kind of knew that this was not even close to a decent explanation for what was going on, it gave me something intelligent to say about the proper pruning of crepe myrtles, and at the correct time of year to deliver that advice. Here's a secret. Whenever I don't know the answer to a question, I try and say something helpful about the plant in question and hope that nobody notices I am evading that question. Then we received a revelatory email from Bob near Nashville, specifically Goodlettsville. Quote, this has happened all over Middle Tennessee. A flash freeze we had 2 winters ago. It went from the 60s to near zero in a few hours with strong winds, froze the sap. About 50% of our crepe myrtles were killed back to the ground. That turning inwards look your listener mentioned is the result of the dead limbs drying out. A lot of shrubs did not survive, he continues, At my place, we lost all our skip laurels, Leyland cypress, and many boxwoods. This past winter, it got down to -2 degrees Fahrenheit, and that finished off any surviving crepes that did try and come back from their roots. There are dead shrubs all over Nashville that landscape companies are actively trying to replace. Hope this helps. Are you kidding me? It more than helps, Bob. It directly answers a question that many Nashville listeners were asking, and that once again I had clearly failed to answer correctly. Couple of useful lessons here. If something happens to your plants that seems to have happened to a lot of people in your area, it's not your fault. Talk with the folks at your local independent garden center. Not a big box store that happens to sell plants. They'll probably know what happened. And I should have considered something like this. Here in the mid-Atlantic, once reliable hydrangeas have failed to bloom during many springs because of early and late frost freezing the flower buds. It only makes sense that such a climactic attack also took down those crepe myrtles. Although their range has been moving northward at a surprisingly fast pace, they are, at their roots, plants that thrive in the south. It's easy to use the term global warming to describe what's happening to our poor planet. And the Earth is clearly getting warmer every year. But, quote, climate change is a much more accurate term, as cold snaps are also getting colder, more frequent, and less predictable. It's like trying to garden in Oregon. That's a little side inside joke to our Oregonian listeners, who have learned not to rely on calendar months for any of their horticultural decisions. On a personal note, I am currently waiting to see if a massive rhododendron that toppled over in my front yard during a springtime combination of suddenly freezing temperatures, wet, heavy snow, and high winds is going to bloom this season. Right now, it's doing a darn good imitation of a diving board. But its roots still seem to be connected to the ground, and the leaves are still green and glossy. And what am I going to do if it does bloom? Try and lift it back up and risk hearing the snap of death? Or am I going to wind up bragging about having the only prostate rhododendron in Pennsylvania? Well, that sure was some insightful information about the trials and tribulations of gardening in a climactically changing world now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure at the Gardens Alive section of the Gurney's website. Just visit the Gurney's website, that's G-U-R-N-E-Y-S, and click on Garden Resources. Or be a coward like me and just search You Bet Your Garden and Gurney's at your favorite searching engine. Yikes, my producer is threatening to run over my rhododendron if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 888-492-9444 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at MikeMcGee@ptd.net. That's Mike McGee at P for Peter, T for Thomas, D for David.net. Always please include your location. We want to know it. You'll find all of our updated contact information, plus audio of this show, audio and video of previous shows, and links to our internationally renowned podcast. It's all at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. Our radio show is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he realized that his childhood world was actually in color. It was only their Dumont TV set that was black and white. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our chief content officer is Joni Greenbaum. Our angel of the airways is Christine Dempsey. And our engineer is always cheerful, Charlie Sarah. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Check out her fine work and keep track of all our updated contact information at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. And like us. Really, really like us. Our peerless princess of profound production is Jasmine Griffin. Our irreplaceable audio editor is the lovely Jonas Bowen. Our CEO emeritus is Tim Fallon. I'm your host, almost emeritus, Mike McGrath, and I'll be moving my little tomato starts into bigger pots in preparation for planting and dreaming of red gravy to come until I can see you again next week.